very good morning to you. It's Rebecca O'Sullivan here with you on Clare FM this Sunday, and welcome to Hindsight, where we look back at some of the biggest and some of the best stories of the week. Coming up, sister to the late Jack Kennelly, who lost his life in a tragic drowning accident in 2018, raises funds and awareness for water safety, calls for incentives to be created to encourage people to report others who illegally dump, and Fesh John Underhill speaks about swimming with Dusty the Dolphin. But first on this morning's show, we turn to Shannon and to the region's airport. On Tuesday's Morning Focus, Gavin Grace spoke with CEO of Shannon Group, Mary Considine, about the group's annual report for 2020. She's calling for the implementation of a clear roadmap to recovery for aviation as the group focuses on recovery and rebuilding and what they expect will be another difficult year for aviation and tourism.
Well, I suppose at this stage, recognising, Gavin, the improving public health outcomes, the reducing risk levels and the rollout of the vaccination programmes in Ireland and indeed the countries that we're linked to by air, all of these should facilitate the reopening of the international aviation, and our whole economy is so dependent on it. And I suppose as an industry, we have come together. We've presented a plan for the reopening of aviation to government. We met with the ministers in early March and presented the finalised plan in April. And I think it sets out very clear criteria for the reopening, very conscious of protecting public health. But our economy is so reliant on aviation. And indeed, if you look to our tourism economy, which is so important to this part of the country, 75% of Ireland's tourism economy is dependent on international visitation. And 90% of those visitors come by air. So it's really important to hundreds of businesses and tens of thousands of jobs that we reopen the inbound market.
What does that plan that you discussed, what does it look like in broad terms? How can you bring aviation back safely?
Well, what it does, it sets out the criteria, a little bit like the traffic light system last year, that Ireland would adopt the EU digital passport system, that there would be clear criteria for travellers that have been vaccinated, have recovered from COVID, or indeed had a negative test for COVID. So it's putting the criteria in place so that we're all clear on what's required to open. And the industry, it's not like just flicking on a light switch and that we can open up our doors next week. You know, aircraft have to be certified, crews have to be brought back. So there's a lead time to reopening aviation. And, you know, Ireland would have been punching above our weight in aviation historically. I think we're now falling behind the curve, and we do really need to set out a clear roadmap because there are so many dependent factors on this.
When you say we're falling behind the curve, in what way and how damaging is that?
Well, it's such a vital industry that if you damage the industry, if we lose airline capacity, it's not easily restored. And I suppose we're very, very conscious as an airport in the regions that if you lose, if services are hard won, and it takes many years to put new services in place, and there is no guarantee, even when aviation reopens, that we're going to get anything back to like the normal levels of activity that we had in 2018, 2019, anytime soon. And indeed, as you and I have spoken about previously, Gavin, all the indications are that airlines and aviation are going to take some time to recover. The forecasts from Eurocontrol and ACI are all looking at a recovery period that will be 2025 before we get back to normal levels of activity. And that's assuming that the vaccine rollout goes to plan and we open up aviation in the second half of this year, which is only July, which is getting very, very close. So there's a huge amount of assumptions even underpinning getting back in 2025. So we need to be very conscious of that, and that we can't take the connectivity that this country and that we had for granted.
Do you feel like it is being taken for granted? You mentioned how you presented your plan to government a month ago. Now the digital passport's been discussed for several months, and Ireland isn't exactly top of the line when it comes to signing up for that system.
Well, I think we're a little bit more optimistic in that, last week we saw the alleviation of many of the restrictions for the domestic economy for within the country. And we're seeing the easing of restrictions and the opening up of some of our hospitality sector over the course of June and hopefully into July, the rest of it. So that gives some confidence. And if that goes well, we're hoping the government will give a clear indication to the aviation industry later this month of their intentions for reopening international aviation. But I suppose we're calling very hard on them now that we do need certainty, and we need, I suppose, that clear plan adopted so we're all clear on what we need to do and when things are to happen.
You need that, as you mentioned and indicated already, you need that lead-in time to prepare for this. Is the summer period a washout already, or when do you think there might be planes returning to the skies in, it won't be normal numbers, but in, shall we say, decent numbers?
Well, we're hoping that if there is an easing on international travel and lifting of restrictions, and again, subject to all the protocols being in place, that there may be some travel later this summer. Ryanair, as you know, announced last Christmas that they were recommencing their base at Shannon for the summer. They announced 14 routes at the time. Since then, they've added the route to Corfu. So they have 15 routes on sale from Shannon from June. Now, that is all dependent on the restrictions. It's at reduced capacity. We would be hopeful that there would be some level of operations for the summer, but it is all dependent on what the measures and the restrictions that are in place at the time. Similarly, Aer Lingus, you know, they're waiting as well for clarity around the roadmap for reopening. And if we get that, you know, we would be confident that there would be some level of activity towards the latter end of the summer. But, you know, this huge variables there, this huge uncertainty still.
You mentioned Aer Lingus. They're committed to Shannon in your eyes?
Well, they have their all the indications from Aer Lingus is that they're awaiting the lifting restrictions, and they're hoping to be back in Shannon on both the UK and transatlantic once we get clarity.
Okay, because obviously that was raised recently by Clare County Council, but it again speaks to your need for decisions to come from government, from Dublin, to allow for clarity, to allow you and airlines and your partners make plans.
Absolutely. Like, there's no doubt that 2021 will be another difficult year for aviation and tourism after a very, very difficult and challenging 2020. But I think there is an opportunity now. There's public health, thankfully, things are looking much, much more positive there. So we are hoping that with the right measures and the restart plan put in place, that we will see a resumption of international travel later on in the summer. And that is really critical, because we need to bring back that key connectivity for both business and tourism. And indeed, all the jobs, you know, in the airport and in this region reliant on that.
Just finally then, you mentioned how it will be a number of years before aviation returns to pre-pandemic levels. How is Shannon equipped for its recovery on that front? I would have concerns that airlines will look to consolidate on, you know, if they're going to pick a route into Ireland, they'll pick Dublin, for example, over some of the other airports, that perhaps the choppy waters ahead could be particularly choppy for the likes of Shannon. What's your assessment?
It will be very challenging for Shannon, not only for Shannon, but for all airports in the regions. And that's why it was we, as part of the task force for the recovery of aviation, set out a clear criteria and conditions for to support the restoration of services back into the regions. Included in that is support for the airports, but crucially support for the airlines, because they've lost huge amount of money since the onset of the pandemic, and they will be needed to need financial support to restore those routes.
More than we've seen so far, including for Shannon?
Absolutely. You know, what has been given so far, and really welcome and really important supports to the industry in the form of the cross-sectoral supports, the wage support and the capital funding for the airport, and they are really welcome. But I think what is going to be crucial to restore connectivity is support for the routes, either through the airports where we can incentivize the airlines or directly to the airlines. And indeed, there will be a requirement for increased funding for Tourism Ireland. Tourism Ireland themselves are calling for a doubling of their budgets over the period of the recovery to try and bring back those inbound markets to position Ireland again as the key destination for international tourism, and indeed support the airlines to bring those visitors into the regions. And that will be really important as part of the recovery plan for aviation.
Okay. And would it be advantageous for Shannon to have a chairperson in place to push its case going forward? I know we're reporting this morning that position's being re-advertised.
Well, that is a matter for government, and we have, as you know, a board in place who have been very supportive and worked very closely with the management team right through the pandemic, because it's been a really challenging time for the industry. So we do understand that the minister and the department are about to kick off a process to fill that role.
That was Shannon Group CEO Mary Considine speaking about the year gone by and the challenges which continue to face the aviation sector. Now, later in the week, reports emerged in the Clare Herald about the possibility of Aer Lingus transatlantic flights not returning from Shannon Airport until 2022. A document is rumoured to be circulating, which includes plans to extend the suspension of the Shannon to Boston and New York routes until spring of next year. Union representatives are downplaying the claims for now, but have confirmed to Clare FM that they're seeking further clarity, whilst Aer Lingus say the schedule for 2021 and beyond is under constant review. On Friday's Morning Focus, Gavin Grace spoke to independent TD from Scariff, Michael McNamara, about this possibility.
Well, obviously I'm very concerned for a variety of reasons. I'm concerned generally about Shannon Airport and in and out of Shannon, because it has obviously almost completely ceased. But I'm also concerned particularly about Aer Lingus, because of, you know, there's a historical lack of commitment to Shannon in a way. I mean, it's, you know, well documented that if there was a problem with a flight serving either Boston or New York from Dublin, that the Shannon flight would be sacrificed to provide the Dublin flight, you know, if there was a problem with a plane or if
that has happened on numerous occasions.
It's happened on numerous occasions. So, I mean, clearly Dublin is a priority and for Aer Lingus, and has been even before its privatisation. And lastly, I mean, Mary Considine has been quite clear and has repeated on numerous occasions that it's going to be a very challenging time for Shannon Airport when aviation resumes, because airlines are going to prioritise the bigger airports and the more guaranteed markets over other airports, and in Ireland that's Dublin. So I mean, you know, I would be very concerned that you might see a prioritisation of Dublin over the other over Shannon.
Do you have any sympathy for Aer Lingus in that they are trading through extraordinary times?
Oh, absolutely.
But Shannon may be a victim of that.
Absolutely, I do. I mean, like, and sorry, it's not just limited. I mean, the whole IAG group, of which Aer Lingus is part, along with Iberia and British Airways, has said that their airlines are going to be operating at 25% capacity in this quarter, and that's across the group. So, I mean, of course I do. But I do think that, you know, that that's right across the world. So, I mean, there's absolutely no doubt but that the aviation sector is very severely impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic everywhere. But I think the situation has been made more difficult for the aviation sector in Ireland by some of the measures that the government have adopted, and in particular the lack of clarity around when there will be a reopening and what that reopening will entail, whether it will entail flights within the European Union only, whether it will entail flights to other countries, third countries like the United States, if so, under what conditions, and what will be done to reopen safely. Because, you know, I've been calling for testing at airports for 12 months now.
Yes.
There was finally some PCR testing was introduced. But, I mean, PCR testing is by its nature quite slow. It's obviously the gold standard, but it's not perhaps suited for rapid testing. Antigen testing is the one favourite for that, and we had we see lots of other countries moving forward with antigen testing to help open up more safely. And we saw the Professor Ferguson, who led a government report into antigen testing. There was a split. I think there were six people on the panel, and it was 4-2 with the two Department of Health personnel against it, and all of the other independent experts in favour of it, including Kingston Mills, who's quite regularly, I think, on the he's a commentator who's spoken in favour of it. Including Professor Paddy Mallon, who you know, would be, I think, in general considered to be quite a cautious voice. He's a professor of immunology, or at least infectious diseases, at UCD, and also a consultant in St. Vincent's, but he has spoken in favour of it and believes that it offers a lot of benefits. But notwithstanding that report in favour of antigen testing, we've seen very little progress to roll out antigen testing in the country other than in the context of meat plants. That, I think, remains, you know, needs to be explained by the government. I mean, if you get a report, if you commission experts to provide a report, I mean, we're constantly being told, well, we need to listen to the experts. But, you know, I think sometimes we need to listen to the experts and we like what they're saying. But when the government doesn't like what they're saying, or when the Department of Health, or when certain agendas within the Department of Health don't like what the experts are saying, well, then they don't listen to them. And this is one instance of that. So I do think that we need to put a plan in place. I'm not saying that everything is going to open up overnight. It's very clear it won't. But we do need to have a plan in place as to what the Irish state's position on aviation is going to be when it looks. And, you know,
and do you take any solace from I mean, yesterday Deputy Crowe was talking about how Ireland would be keen to sign up and quick to sign up for the digital passports, for example, and perhaps he's suggesting within 6 weeks we could see some movement on that front.
Well, I mean, I heard Simon Coveney, who's the Minister for Foreign Affairs, on RTE the evening before, and I thought he was a lot more circumspect. So I hope that Ireland will sign up to that, because I think we are a member, obviously, of the European Union. There's so much fuss about Brexit, and now it's almost forgotten when the government is planning its next responses to COVID-19 that we are members of the European Union. And of course, every other country in the European Union is grappling with exactly the same issues that we are. So I do think that I would like to see them move in conjunction with other EU member states in terms of the digital green pass, which might enable...
move quickly as well.
Well, move as quickly as other countries are moving. I mean, not move more quickly than other countries are moving, but move as quickly. And secondly, then, with regard to whatever decisions are made with regard to opening up to travel for other countries outside the European Union, which are determined to be relatively safe, such as the United States, because of the high levels of vaccination, that we move in that front as well. Because, you know, obviously the other airlines that serve the transatlantic routes at Shannon have also pulled out. And I think we do need to get transatlantic flights back into Shannon as soon as possible. And we need to get flights to Heathrow back into Shannon as soon as possible, because they have been...
Sorry to cut across you. I was just going to say, on that point, I just note you mentioned IAG, the parent company of Aer Lingus. They reported their Q1 financial results this morning. They've got a pretty steep financial loss in that period, unsurprisingly. But I also note the Irish Times reporting that they drew down 75 million out of an agreed 150 million euro debt facility provided by the Irish state during the first 3 months of the year. We don't own a share in Aer Lingus anymore, of course, but if the state is providing such significant funding to the company, should that not come with strings attached to it? We look after you, but you must look after and maintain your services in our airports.
Well, I mean, I suppose the way to do that was through taking an equity share. I mean, that's what Germany did. I mean, they put significant sums of money into Lufthansa, but in return for putting those sums of money in, they took an equity share in Lufthansa. Now it's a share that they intend to sell off as the aviation sector pulls out of this slump. But we didn't. I mean, that's an approach that I would have suggested to government, and I don't think it was unique in that. But it's one that the government, for reasons best known to itself, decided not to adopt. But I would agree with you that if you're going to give significant sums of money to a sector, you would expect that it comes with some conditionality. But you know, the Irish example isn't a great one. I mean, we put vast sums of money into banks not very long ago, and you know, we see now how they're treating their public service obligations in places like Tulla and Milton Malbay in particular. I mean, obviously they're retaining an ATM in Kiki, but I mean, retaining an ATM, you would imagine, is not a huge amount to expect a bank to do in circumstances where they were bailed out by the Irish state.
Certainly doesn't amount to a branch.
History repeats itself. No, I'm not suggesting it does amount to a branch.
Of course, yeah.
But it's a lot better than not having an ATM. Okay. So I mean, like, these are small things, but if we can't achieve that in the banking sector, where we have a control, you know, banking licenses are strictly controlled. The governor of the central bank is supposed to be notified of any plans, and notwithstanding all of that sort of infrastructure in place, we're not able to get banks to do something as simple as provide an ATM. I mean, I do think that the government needs to take a look at how society is regulated in Ireland and how the economy is regulated and what tools are available to it to regulate, because it's been a very kind of hands-off approach up to now.
Okay. Just briefly then, in terms of Aer Lingus going forward, it seems the most strident calls that have been made at the minute are for clarity from the airline. Is that now what is needed in your view?
With clarity from the airline and clarity from government. Both. I mean, the airline will say that they can't provide clarity until the government provides clarity. Now, I completely accept that there's a pandemic and it's unpredictable, and the government, you know, with the best of intentions, could announce certain dates and not be able to meet them for objectively verifiable reasons to do with case numbers, etc. I accept that, but I mean, that doesn't mean that they shouldn't be making concrete plans and laying out those plans. And the airlines in return could and should be expected to lay out plans in response to that.
Okay. Just before I let you go, I wanted to ask you as well this morning for your own views on the policies that are being pursued by government to tackle not just these cuckoo funds buying houses, but also making more affordable housing available, taking an equity in share in people's home, ironically, after what we were just talking. Do you think that is the way to go to unlock the potential for more people to get onto the housing ladder?
Yeah, I mean, look, the cuckoo funds coming in to build houses, I don't have a problem with, but coming in to buy houses that have already been built and therefore taking them off the market that ordinary people can hope to aspire to is a huge problem. But, you know, in a way, our local authorities have done the same thing. I mean, for a long time, Clare County Council and every other local authority, this isn't a criticism of Clare County Council in particular, were going out into the market and buying houses for the past 10 years effectively, primarily buying houses instead of building houses. And of course, for every house they buy, that's a house that a young couple or a young person or a young family can't bid on, because obviously they're not going to be able to outbid Clare County Council. So we have a general problem in Ireland with nobody's building houses, everybody's looking to buy houses, including these investment funds and including local authorities. We do need to return to, I think, local authorities building houses on local authority land. And one of the few achievements maybe of the government that I supported from 11 to 16 was that local authority lands and state lands weren't sold. I mean, there was huge pressure when the country was in the economic hole it was to sell off state-owned land, but that land was retained. It can now be built on. It's there to be built on if we put a strategy in place. We were, you know, housing estates were built in Scariff, built in every single, there isn't a town in Clare that housing estates weren't built on when this country had a lot less money available to it than it does now. So I do think we need to get back into the business of building houses.
We need the private sector to contribute, though, as well.
I said that at the start.
Yes, you did. I suppose the reason I just point that out is because, yes, we need to build houses, but I suppose the big question is, will giving people access to a state leg up as they try to get a mortgage, will that, do you feel, ultimately see the private sector deliver more supply?
But I mean, there's a danger in that you end up with the state subsidising a private sector, that you end up artificially raising, if that is the only mechanism in place, there's a danger that you end up artificially raising the price of houses because the private sector know that this money is available. In the same way that, for example, you know, every time the government announced some payments for beef farmers in return for bad prices, the factories pull prices further because they know that, well, the farmers are getting this amount of money, so we can factor that in what we're paying. I mean, there's a danger that you have big international funds factoring in what the government are going to be giving people into the price that they're going to be charging for houses. And, of course, then you have the government also through the various rental schemes paying state money inevitably to these private sector funds for the rental of those houses. So I don't have a problem with the private sector. Obviously, a lot of houses in Clare are built privately, and that's a good thing. People who are able to afford to buy a site or have a site and are able to persuade a bank to give them a mortgage and proceed and build a house, that's a good thing. Funds likewise doing something similar but on a bigger scale, but there has to be okay. public sector housing as well. I mean, it's not one or the other, I don't think, is the solution. It's a combination of both, and we've been overly reliant on the private sector.
And we know you expressed your own unease at the actions of Cuckoo Funds buying housing estates that are being built or buying them off the plans. The government, on the foot of the reports of recent days, looks set to act to tackle this. But can I just ask you, and I'm going to put you on the spot here, I know, but as a barrister, is that legal for them to ban Cuckoo Funds from buying estates? The Constitution enshrines the right to private property.
It does, and that's something I don't have an answer to off the top of my head. You'll forgive me for that.
But
one thing we need to make sure is that they don't have, because, you know, ordinary people don't get huge tax incentives for buying a house, and we need to make sure that Cuckoo Funds aren't getting huge tax incentives, and it would be perfectly legal to remove any artificial tax incentives that were put in place. Now,
that needs to be done quickly, I presume.
And that needs to be done very quickly, and I think that's, I mean, if there's a distortion of the market by the tax treatment of these funds that rewards them for doing exactly that which they're doing, and it's damaging to Irish society and the Irish economy in a broader sense, then that needs to be tackled quickly. I mean, the issue of, I mean, they're doing it because it's profitable, and they're doing it because they obviously can turn a book on it. I mean, they're not doing it because of any particular attraction to Ireland. I mean, these are international funds, so it's all down to what incentives are in place. And I think the government needs to look at the tax system in the first instance, and then you know, there might be no need to ban them if they weren't getting artificial tax incentives. And that's something that the constitutionality, if you'll forgive me, but it's something that would require one to look into in a lot greater detail.
No, it's just, I know, I appreciate I'm putting you on the spot.
But there's absolutely no constitutional, there's nothing to prevent any artificial tax incentives. Just as, you know, private individuals, there was an incentivization to buy houses in certain, was it section 20, I've forgotten section, you know, it was during the Celtic early years, the Celtic Tiger, was it section 22 or section 20, whatever, but that was ultimately removed. I mean, tax incentives can be removed without any constitutional difficulties.
Independent TD from Scariff, Michael McNamara, on the possibility of Aer Lingus transatlantic flights not returning to Shannon until next spring. He also touched upon the publishing of the government's affordable housing bill in his conversation with Gavin on Friday. Now, coming up, we hear from the sister of the late Jack Kennelly, who lost his life in a drowning accident 3 years ago, and her efforts to raise funds and awareness for water safety. Welcome back to Hindsight here on Clare FM with myself, Rebecca O'Sullivan. In 2018, the tragic loss of two Clare teens left this county reeling. Jack Kennelly and Shay Maloney, both 15, were swimming in an abandoned quarry just outside of Venice when they tragically lost their lives in a drowning accident. Jack's sister Danielle has recently co-founded a candle and wax melts business called Wicks and Wax. Now, for the month of May, their Daisy Snap bar has turned blue for Water Safety Ireland, with all the profits from the bar going towards the charity. Danielle spoke to Gavin Grace on Thursday's Morning Focus about the fundraiser, but firstly, about leaving her day job to pursue her business full time.
Definitely. It was a big leap for us both to leave our jobs, but I suppose it was one that needed to be made to give the business our full time.
Well, the very best of luck, and I hope that continues to go well. We're talking about something which is linked with that business this morning, but is also linked with something I know which touched you and your family very much. And in fact, it touched an awful lot of people in 2018 when your brother Jack and Shay Maloney, the two teenagers, drowned in the quarry at Knockanean in Ennis. Mm-hmm. And that's inspired a fundraising initiative. Would you mind telling us about that first of all?
Yeah, of course. So I suppose it is coming up to the third anniversary of Jack's death. So we're doing it for the month of May, as his anniversary is at the end of May. And I suppose it's an important time too for water safety, to have it in the forefront of people's minds coming into the better weather. We did want to promote that water safety aspect as well, and just to have people, I suppose, think twice about potentially swimming in an unsafe environment. So that's the reason behind the whole campaign. And then there is a fundraising aspect to it as well. So we're selling our Daisy Bar, which is a little snap bar. It's one of our wax melts. And all the profits for Daisy will go to Water Safety Ireland for the whole month of May. The little bar itself is actually normally yellow, but we've turned it blue for the month just to incorporate the water aspect of it.
Very good.
And with every purchase, we have a small little brochure that gives, just gives some water safety advice as well, so that...
fingers crossed.
I suppose if you were to look at it, it does spell Daisy, and each water safety tip starts with a letter of the Daisy, so it's quite cute.
I know why you've done it. You've been personally affected by this area, but maybe talk to me about the thought process about taking the step, because it is, this is obviously a very painful memory for you and for your family.
It is, and I suppose the real initiative behind it all is to, I suppose, prevent another family from going through what we went through. And myself and my business partner, Chantelle, kind of went into it with the attitude that if this stops one person, or has one person kind of second guessing what they're doing when it comes to swimming in an unsafe environment, and it saves just even one person's life, then everything we've done, you know, in the lead up and throughout the month will have been worth it.
Is it difficult, though, to confront these memories?
It is. I suppose, obviously, we're in a much better place now, 3 years on, than we were at the time. It'll never be easy, you know. I suppose thinking about what happened, or even just missing Jack, that'll never get any easier. But I suppose I can look at it now that he would be proud of what we're doing, and, you know, he'd be proud of the fact that we're trying to save other people from going through what he went through, and save other families from going through that grief as well.
When you talk about, when you think about what happened, and I don't want to dig up rough memories or anything like that, but is it hard to put those memories to one side and remember your brother for the person he was, the personality he was, the boy that you loved?
It is, and it has been hard for, you know, for the 3 years trying to separate the two, but it's something, I suppose, that you do learn over time, is that you try not to think about the bad things, and it makes it easier to think about the nice memories rather than to think about the fact that he died, or what happened, or how he died. So I suppose that's something that we try to do on a day-to-day basis anyway, regardless of any fundraiser.
You try and separate the horrible events and the horrible memories and remember everything that went before it.
Exactly. And that does, I suppose, and not that it makes it easier, but to think about the good things is, and, you know, puts you in a much better place than to think about the bad stuff.
Of course, absolutely, indeed. You had huge support as a family, I know, at the time, and no doubt since as well, since his passing.
Yeah, we have. Even, you know, the time of the funeral, Ennis is, as I've come to know, it's a very supportive community, and I've learned that through Jack's passing, through the start of our business, and even now, we haven't even had a full week with the fundraiser, and the support has absolutely been phenomenal. And it is just kind of Ennis and Clare as a community is quite like that anyway. I've come to
And in all my years here, I remember it really affecting people, and really, you know, two young boys, two strapping young lads in the prime of their lives cut down, that really touched and affected a lot of people. And I think that's probably seen in the response as well, whereby, because people, obviously they weren't affected in the same way you were, Danielle, but because they were, because you could, any parent could relate to it, because any grandparent could relate to it, to the grief that you must have been going through, people were very quick to stand up and to support you and come together and rally around you, which I can only hope brings some comfort and continues to do so.
Absolutely. And even, I suppose, you see that the same people that were there at that time have been very supportive with the campaign and the fundraiser so far. So it is quite nice to see that.
And you mentioned this was a Daisy bar. Was a Daisy, is there a connection between Jack and Daisies? Or?
There is, actually. So I suppose, strange enough for a 15-year-old boy to have a Daisy, I suppose, with him, but he used to keep a little daisy in the back of his phone, you know, so that it would dry out.
Yeah.
And it was just always there. If it got a little bit ratty looking, he'd change it around. And it's just something he always had there. So I suppose it's something that our family has kind of clung on to as a little memory of him.
Very nice. And
I suppose that's the reason behind the daisy then as well.
Of course. And he's here now inspiring it. And I think what's... I know that to discuss this isn't easy, and I appreciate your time, but I think what I hope can come from this is that people can support you in the initiative and in turn support Water Safety Ireland, and as you said, try and hopefully prevent a tragedy happening somewhere at some stage in the future.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, I suppose, the goal behind it all is to make sure that, I suppose, we're kind of trying to target that kind of age group as well, where that, you know, you don't necessarily have all the sense that an adult would have, and these things, like, you just don't look at as dangerously when you're that age. So yeah. I suppose the message to get across is that if you are to go swimming in the nicer weather, just make sure it is somewhere where there is a lifeguard. Make sure you're not by yourself, and just that there is always someone there who can help you out if you do get into a bit of a struggle.
Absolutely, indeed. How can people help this fund, help you with this fundraiser? Where do they need to go? What do they need to do?
So the bars are actually for sale on our website, so they're available for home delivery or for collection, and they'll also be available in Coote's shop and in Sweet and Green as well. So in both those places, all the profits will also be going to Water Safety Ireland as well.
Very good. And your own website?
Our own website is wixandmaxireland.com.
That was Danielle Kennelly, sister to the late Jack, who sadly drowned in 2018. The Daisy Bars are available to buy from Wix and Wax Ireland, that's W-I-X and W-A-X Ireland.com, or from Coote's Shop or Sweet and Green Cafe, with all proceeds going to Water Safety Ireland for the month of May. Now coming up, calls for incentives to encourage people to report those who illegally dump. Welcome back to the final part of this morning's Hindsight with myself, Rebecca O'Sullivan. At this month's meeting of the Ennis Municipal District, Fianna Fáil councillor Pat Daly put forward a motion calling for the council to consider finding ways to incentivise members of the public to report those who dump illegally. He spoke to Gavin Grace about his proposal on Friday's Morning Focus.
I was down in Lane there in Pennell Street there the other day, brought down two officials from the environment section of Clare County Council, Jerry Murphy and Marie O'Neill, and what we saw was absolutely terrible. Jerry Murphy took 15 bags out, they were just thrown on the ground, and no tiles, bricks and tiles, we're talking about...
Yeah, it's just been done up in the last couple of months, yeah.
Yeah, and that was black as day as it fades. There's grease coming down from flats in apartments all over the place there. And if anyone went down, it's beside Constance Pub in Pamela Street, office they call it. And it's absolutely terrible. The tiles are black from grease coming down. They're putting it into their sinks. And bags all over. Mr. Murphy took away about 15 bags that day, and he had taken a lot of bags previously, like, you know. Another day I was out in Ballybeg Woods, and I go out there occasionally, and parked the car in the car park, came back about 45 minutes later, and there was a load of carpet left on the car park, you know. Now, there was three or four cars there. Surely to God, someone saw it.
And that was presumably daylight hours?
Daylight hours, yeah.
And just going back to Parnell Street, you referenced a business there. That was just a geographic connection. You're not insinuating anything there. I know but it has come from somebody who's brazen enough to dump that rubbish in the middle of the town centre.
Well, we're talking to local people living there, like, that have seen it happen. But they're afraid of their life to report it. That is the problem, you know.
Why would they be afraid to report?
There could be a repercussion, you know. I mean, people, you know, they're fear, you know. You report someone, they could come back to you somewhere, you know.
So, in other words, if somebody's brazen enough to go dumping rubbish, they might be brazen enough to try and exact revenge on those who report them for doing so.
Absolutely. And I've heard of people from Innes going out to the countryside and throwing bottles into a field, bags of bottles and rubbish. You know, it's terrible, absolutely terrible stuff. You know?
So, going back then to your idea, you're suggesting this incentive scheme. In what form could that incentive come?
No, that's the $6 million question, Gavin. I don't know.
Well, if it was $6 million, I'd say it had plenty of people coming forward.
It could be a civic reception, a civic recognition, like, you know, give a person a certificate or something. You know, it is a difficult one. I know there's a lot of people out there, or even your listeners there might have ideas how to stop this. You see, the council can only do so much, but there are people out there that can see these things happening and report it and be rewarded for it, you know. And, you know, it is only at an early stage yet, but I think it's going to gather momentum, you know, because, you know, look at the worst thing you can do is just throw a bag of rubbish on the street or in the country into a field. Like, it is, you know, it is totally non-civic. You know, it is terrible. It's against every rule that I've ever heard of anyway.
Of course,
you know,
and I don't dispute that. And it is a shame, I think, on a large section of society, and we discussed it earlier in the week in the context of our coastal areas, how this is happening to a greater extent than many of us would like to admit. I think the problem, though, even with what you're suggesting, well-intentioned and all as it is, Councillor Daly, that if I come forward and say I saw Joe Bloggs dumping rubbish, Joe Bloggs says they didn't, it's one person's word against another. Do you think it's really going to act as a deterrent?
Well, I think just two type of people. These people that want to go anonymous, you know what I mean, when they're reported, they want their names reported. But there are people there that are prepared to put their names forward and prepared to go to court, you know what I mean? And obviously, if they went to court, they should be compensated for doing that as well. But, you know, it's a difficult one.
Fianna Fáil Ennis Councillor Pat Daly there on his proposal to create incentives to report the people who dump illegally. Now, finally on this morning's programme, regular guest on Morning Focus, vet John Underhill, told a more irregular story this week about diving and swimming with Dusty the Dolphin. He chatted to Gavin on Wednesday's show.
Well, first of all, the video that I posted was actually filmed by one of our members, Finbar Smith. So it wasn't my video footage, but I put it up there. It's quite an amazing piece of video. We had planned to dive on Saturday there outside Milton Malvey near the White Strand, and about eight members of the club did a shore dive there, just off Bray Point, just some under water arches there, which are very scenic. And Dusty the Dolphin has been known to sort of turn up there now and again, and lo and behold, in some beautiful conditions, because it was very sunny in the afternoon.
Yes,
we got, she turned up on her dive and stayed with us for, you know, 50 minutes or so underwater.
No,
including the arches, which was beautiful. You know, so it was quite a sight.
Now, Dusty has been known to seek out people. I know people, certain, will say you shouldn't swim it or whatever, but it's looking at the footage that you and others have posted online, this seems to have been an idyllic, tranquil, almost heavenly-like swim.
Yeah. The conditions were, of course, they were lovely. I mean, it was very, very calm water. The tide was out and it's relatively shallow as well, so we were able to get lots of colour. There was very little sediment in the sea because it had very sort of calm sea all week, so it was just perfect. And we had two of our youngest divers in the club with us, with their father, he actually filmed the bit that I put up, and so it was fabulous for them, and it's fabulous for diving to see young people out enjoying themselves and sort of getting in there with seeing this sort of thing. And actually, one of the divers, one of the girls, saw this, interacted with Dusty. It was quite incredible. Dusty seemed to mimic her hand movements, and if you watch it closely on the video, she rotates her hand to the left, and Dusty does the same thing, and she nods her head, and Dusty does the same thing. It's sort of almost mimicking her behaviour. And I've never seen this before. I've dived many, many times with Dusty over the years. She's around a couple of decades now, at least. And this is the first time I saw that. She often plays, and I mean, let's face it, she's a wild animal, and there has been reports of attacks now. So we have to be sort of, you know, the caveat is that, you know, we shouldn't really dive with her or swim with her, but she just turned up with us on Saturday and wanted to play, and, you know, followed us around on the dive and was very curious about us, and of course we were very curious about her. You know, so it's it was just one of those wonderful sort of dive of a lifetime, really. I think,
absolutely,
you know,
and the, you know. And you've mentioned the conditions aiding you, but having the cameras there as well, the GoPros or whatever it was, the footage that's come out of it is extraordinary as well.
Yeah, there's been a lot of interest in it. A lot of media outlets have grabbed it. Philip Brummel from RTE did a little piece on it, and he grabbed some of the footage that we've given him, and he's put it together as a story, and it's really, really beautiful, you know, to watch. So it was incredible, really, because I think what was wonderful about it was that the sea conditions, you know, for Atlantic conditions, which are hard to get, those type of conditions were just right. It was lovely and calm. It was a sunny afternoon, so there was plenty of light. It was a shallow, safe dive, and you know, Dusty was curious and stayed with us. She even came in at the end of the dive, right into the shore. You could have patted her on the head, to be honest with you, at knee deep in water. She came right in beside us to see us off.
Fantastic.
At the end of it, it was quite an afternoon.
It's a different chat to what we normally have. And look, you're right. You pointed out she's a wild animal, and people have come into contact and been hurt with Dusty in different times before and in very different circumstances. You weren't looking for this; it happened. But it's been a great experience.
Great
ad for diving as well.
Absolutely. That's what we're trying to get out of it, really, I suppose, is to promote the sport of diving, and to get young people in particular into it, because it's we have the conditions on the West Coast here to do that, and particularly in Clare. So it's a beautiful hobby to undertake, and there's so much to learn from it, you know, and an appreciation of the ocean, really. And the wildlife that we see in it.
John Underhill from Burn Vets there, telling about his experience of swimming with Dusty the dolphin whilst diving with the Burn Sub Aqua Club this week. Now, unfortunately, that's all the time I have left on this morning's show, but do join me again at the same time next week for another edition of Hindsight. And until then, stay safe and keep it tuned here to Clare FM.